Hello, Illinois Radio Reader listeners. This is Elizabeth McMahon with the Decatur Herald and Review for Monday, May 12th. We have a lot of state and national and international news today. I'm going to do a mixture of those, starting with the front page here on page A1. We have a very large photo of two men on a utility pole with the headline, Showcase of Skills, and and the subhead here reads, Central Illinois Ameren Employees Advance to International Rodeo. And I will begin. This is also by Donette Beckett of the Lee newspaper chain. Ready to spur on one another, Ameren Illinois line workers from across the company competed in a playoff at the local lineman's rodeo this past week. The competition determined the top teams and individuals who will represent Ameren Illinois at the International Rodeo this fall. Last year, Jason Novak from Marion and his team placed first in the 2024 International Lineman's Rodeo. With a team ready to work with him again, he's going back to regain his title. I've had a lot of teammates over the years. It's been blessed with some really good ones, he said. It's helped me get where I am today. Together with Clayton Gully and Austin Lewis, also from Marion, the team won the pole climb and hurt man rescue events at the Decatur tryouts. It takes a lot of practice for the team, Novak said. We have to do a lot of practicing to be able to work together, communicate well, not only to do it fast, but to do it safe. 12 teams of three tried out during the latest competition on Thursday in Decatur. The events are designed to test workers' skills, the supervisor said. They will compete with utility teams from around the country, as well as from Australia, Brazil, Jamaica, and the Bahamas. The journeyman line workers have been with Ameren, Illinois for more than 3 years. Apprentices who are employees less than 3 years will have their own competition. According to Brian Bretzik, Ameren Public and Media Relations Manager, the journeyman line workers are required to try out for the international competition. Everything that you see them doing really does represent what they do on a daily basis, he said. The exception is the hurt man rescue. Line workers are trained to rescue a coworker suffering from a medical issue while on a 40-foot utility pole. A 150-pound lifelike mannequin is used to represent the injured coworker. That's something everyone has to train for who climbs a pole, Bretch said. They have to know how to safely bring down an injured person. Another event includes an agility climb in which the line workers climb up the pole with an egg in their mouths. The goal is to keep the egg intact. A third event, the mystery event, is unveiled during the rodeos. The activity is related to their daily job. It's an actual working scenario, Novak said. You have to prepare a game plan, but sometimes that game plan will change during the competition. The training center for Ameren Illinois journeymen line workers is in Decatur. We introduce the training and field work right here at this center, said Kevin Young, electric training manager. Line crew foreman Jason Kenter came from Mattoon to try out for the rodeo. His team has competed at the international level in the past year and will return this year. During this year's tryouts, Kenter, along with Blake Met and Clint Dazenbrock, both from Effingham, won the overall journey line worker title as well as the journeyman mystery competitions. It's a little bit of work, but it's fun, Kenter said, and we compare where we are with other people in other places, how they do stuff. Along with the opportunity to show off their skills, the International Rodeo allows the employees a chance to see the newest tools and equipment in their field. They have a pretty good showcase out there, Kenter said. Because of the high interest among the employees to compete in the rodeo, the company hosts the local tryouts. We don't have the funding to take everybody willing to participate, so we try to take the best six teams and the best six apprentices, Young said. The International Rodeo will be October 15 through 18 in Overland Park, Kansas. Prizes will include a belt and other rewards, in addition to the pride that goes along with winning, Young said. Line persons will have the opportunity to network with others in the field. It gives them the opportunity to hone their skills, Young added. We try to live up to the level and the benchmark that we set for ourselves. Preparation for the competition is a highlight for the competitors as well. The rodeos teach you how to look at things a bit different, to be more efficient in your everyday job, too, Novak said. And I also wanted to include the lineup of journeymen who are competing in the International Linemen's Rodeo. And one is Jason Novak, Clayton Gully, and Austin Lewis from Marion. And they're in the pole climb and hurt man rescue events. Number two is Blake Mett and Clint Dazenbrock, both from Effingham. Jason Kenter from Mattoon. And those are overall line worker title and journeyman mystery. Number three is Pat Rogers from Champaign, Jacob Carr from Beardstown, Milton Draper from Alton, who's a runner-up. And number four is Kent DeKemper and Ethan Cox, both from Centralia, Robbie Emery from Marion, runner-up. Number five is Brian Courtright from Decatur, Ryan Johns and Joe Davidson, both from Marion, runner-up. Vincent Napolitano from Peoria, John McDonough, and Robert Lundholm, both from Washington, and runners-up. And the apprentices are Zach Fox from Danville, Jacob Weeder from Danville, Mark Bartazzoli from Decatur, Devin Richards, Decatur, Blake Michael from Bloomington, Troy Donaldson from Decatur. Moving on the front page of the Herald and Review, we have a Pope Leo XVI story from over the weekend. This is an Associated Press story by Nicole Winfield and Giovanna Del Orto. And the headline reads, Pope Leo XVI calls for peace in Ukraine and Gaza in symbolically rich blessing on Mother's Day. Pope Leo XVI called for a genuine and just peace in Ukraine and an immediate ceasefire in Gaza in his first Sunday noon blessing as pontiff that featured some symbolic gestures suggesting a message of unity in a polarized Catholic Church. I, too, address the world's great powers by repeating the ever-present call, never again war, Leo said from the loggia of St. Peter's Basilica to an estimated 100,000 people below. It was the first time that Leo had returned to the Loggia since he first appeared to the world on Thursday evening following his remarkable election as Pope, the first from the United States. Then, too, he delivered a message of peace. Leo was picking up the papal tradition of offering a Sunday blessing at noon, but with some twists. Whereas his predecessors delivered the greeting from the studio window of the Apostolic Palace off to the side of the piazza, Leo went to the very center of the square and the heart of the church. Part of that was logistics. He didn't have access to the papal apartments in the palace until later Sunday, when they were unsealed for the first time since Pope Francis's death. Leo also offered a novelty by singing the Regina Caeli prayer, a Latin prayer said during the Easter season, which recent popes would usually just recite and harked back to the old Latin Mass of the past. Traditionalists and conservatives, many of whom felt alienated by Pope Francis's reforms and loose liturgical style, have been looking for gestures hinting at Leo's priorities. Some have expressed cautious optimism at the very best with a return to a traditional style that Leo exhibited on Thursday night when he emerged for the first time wearing the formal red cape of the papacy that Francis had eschewed. He followed up on Saturday by wearing the brocaded papal stole during a visit to a Marian sanctuary south of Rome. There he knelt in reverence and greeted the crowd surrounded by priests in long cassocks, usually favored by conservatives. Aldo Maria Valli, a conservative Italian journalist who writes a popular blog, said he appreciated these gestures and urged traditionalists to give Leo a chance, saying he liked a lot of what he's seen so far. Don't shoot Leo, he wrote. On Sunday, Leo wore the simple white cassock of the papacy and reverted back to wearing his silver pectoral cross. He had worn a more ornate one that contains the relics of St. Augustine and his mother, St. Monica, on Thursday night that had been given to him by his Augustinian religious order. On hand in the square on Sunday for Leo's first noon prayer were two of Europe's more firebrand conservatives, France's Marine Le Pen and Italy's Matteo Salvini. The Italian minister has highlighted his Catholic faith in his political messaging. Leo quoted Pope Francis in denouncing the number of conflicts ravaging the globe today, saying it was a third world war in pieces. "I carry in my heart the sufferings of the beloved Ukrainian people," he said. "Let everything possible be done to achieve genuine, just, and lasting peace as soon as possible." He called for the release of war prisoners and the return of Ukrainian children to their families, and welcomed the ceasefire between India and Pakistan. He also called for an immediate ceasefire in Gaza and for humanitarian relief to be provided to the exhausted civilian population and all hostages be freed. Leo also noted that Sunday was Mother's Day in many countries and wished all mothers, including those in heaven, a happy Mother's Day. The crowd, filled with marching bands in town for a special Jubilee weekend, erupted in cheers and music as the bells of St. Peter's Basilica tolled. Angela Gentile of Bari arrived in the square 3 hours early to be in place, nonplussed but the cardinals had elected yet another non-Italian pope. She said she was happy Leo came to the central balcony of the basilica so the crowds could see him face to face. "What's good for the Holy Spirit works for me," she said. "I have trust." More than 50 pilgrims from Houston, Texas, were in the square, too, waving three large American flags. They were in Rome on a pre-planned Holy Year pilgrimage and said they were proud to be part of this historic occasion. "Words cannot express my admiration and gratitude to God," said the Reverend Dominic Nguyen, who led the Vietnamese-American group. He said he hoped the Pope would be happy to see the Stars and Stripes, but also Peruvian flags and all other countries showing the universality of the Church. Also Sunday, Leo celebrated a private Mass near the tomb of St. Peter and prayed at the tombs of several past popes in the grottos underneath the basilica. Vatican media filmed him praying before a mix of more progressive and traditional-minded popes. Paul VI, who closed out the modernizing reforms of the 1960s, Second Vatican Council, and Popes Pius XII and Benedict on the more conservative end of the spectrum. Let's see here. That would be Benedict the 16th. He celebrated the Mass with the head of his Augustinian order, and his brother John in the pews. In his homily, he recalled that Sunday was also the day that the Catholic Church celebrates religious vocations, and noted that the issue of declining vocations had been raised by cardinals in their pre-conclave discussions before his election. Leo said priests can encourage more vocations by offering a good example, living the joy of the gospel, not discouraging others, but rather looking for ways to encourage young people to hear the voice of the Lord and to follow it and to serve in the church. Leo also attended the official unsealing of the papal apartments in the Apostolic Palace, which were sealed after Francis's April 21st death. It's unclear if Leo will move into the apartments or just use them for formal audiences, as Francis did. The 69-year-old Chicago-born missionary was elected 267th Pope on Thursday. He has a busy week of audiences before his formal installation Mass next Sunday. And finally, on the front page of the Herald and Review, we have a transportation-focused story. This is by Jeff Murray of the Associated Press, and with the headline, U.S. States Push for Speed-Limiting Devices on the Cars of Dangerous Drivers. A teenager who admitted being addicted to speed behind the wheel had totaled two other cars in the year before he slammed into a minivan at 112 miles per hour in a Seattle suburb, killing the driver and three of the five children she was transporting for a homeschool co-op. After sentencing Chase Daniel Jones last month to more than 17 years in prison, the judge tacked on a novel condition should he drive again. His vehicle must be equipped with a device that prevents accelerating far beyond the speed limit. Virginia this year became the first state to give its judges such a tool to deal with the most dangerous drivers on the road. Washington, D.C. already is using it, and similar measures await governor's signatures in Washington State and Georgia. New York and California could also soon tap the GPS-based technology to help combat a recent national spike in traffic deaths. "It's a horror no one should have to experience," said Amy Cohen, who founded the victims' advocacy group Families for Safe Streets, after her 12-year-old son, Sammy Cohen Eckstein, was killed by a speeding driver in front of their New York home more than a decade ago. Andrea Hudson, 38, the minivan driver who was killed when Jones ran a red light, was building a backyard greenhouse with her husband to help educate several kids who shuttle between homes during the school day, her father Ted Smith said. Also killed in the March 2024 crash near Hudson's home in Renton, Washington, were Boyd, or Buster Brown, and Eloise Wilcoxon, both 12, and Matilda Wilcoxon, 13. Hudson's two children were sitting on the passenger side and survived, but they spent weeks in a hospital. "You always hear of these horrific accidents, and it's always far away. You don't know anybody, but all of a sudden, that's my daughter," Smith said. "The guy did not swerve or brake, and it was just a missile." Smith knew Washington State Representative Mari Levitt, who reached out to offer condolences and tell him she was sponsoring legislation to mandate intelligent speed assistance devices as a condition for habitual speeders to get back their suspended licenses. Levitt predicts it will have an even more powerful impact than revoking driving privileges, citing studies showing around 3/4 of people who lose their licenses get behind a wheel anyway. Between 2019 and 2024, the state saw a 200% increase in drivers cited for going at least 50 miles per hour over the speed limit, according to the Washington Traffic Safety Commission. "I guess I don't understand why someone is compelled to want to drive that fast," Levitt said. "But if they choose to drive that fast with a speed limiter, they can't. It's going to stop them in their tracks." The measure, which Washington legislators passed last month and Democratic Governor Bob Ferguson is expected to sign soon, is called the BEAM Act, using the first letters of the names of the four victims, Buster, Eloise, Andrea, and Matilda. Because Jones, 19, didn't receive a speeding ticket in his two previous crashes, he likely wouldn't have been required to use the speed limiter ahead of the fatal one. And because it could be 2029 before the law takes effect, the judge's requirement at sentencing only applies to his time on probation after being released from prison, Smith said. Competing tech companies that joined forces to lobby for ignition interlock requirements for drunken drivers have been working in unison again the past few years to pitch intelligent speed assistance. Brandy Nannini, chief government affairs officer at one manufacturer, Grapevine, Texas-based Smart Start, said fleet vehicles, including school buses in the nation's capital, have been trying it out for years. But it took a lot of refinement before the GPS technology could instantly recognize speed limit changes and compel vehicles with the devices to install to adjust accordingly. "We've got a lot more satellites in the sky now," said Ken Denton, a retired police officer who's the chief compliance officer at Cincinnati-based Lifesaver, part of the coalition of companies. When court mandated the devices would prevent cars from exceeding speed limits or whatever threshold regulators set. An override button allows speeding in emergencies, but states can decide whether to activate it, and authorities would be alerted any time the button is pushed. A more passive version, which beeps to alert drivers when they're going too fast, is required for new cars in the European Union. California Governor Gavin Newsom voted a similar proposal last year, explaining vehicle safety requirements are set by the federal government, and he was concerned a patchwork of state laws could stir confusion. Before Delegate Patrick Hope agreed to sponsor the proposal in the Virginia legislature, he tried out the device in Nannini's car, which was calibrated to not more than 9 miles per hour over the speed limit. "That was my first question. Is it safe?" Hope said. Not only did he come away convinced it was safe, Hope is now pondering whether to install it on the cars of his three children, all of whom are new drivers. For those mandated by a court, the price could be hefty, $4 per day and a $100 installation fee. The fee would be reduced for low-income offenders. Cohen, with Families for Safe Streets, which provides support services to loved ones of crash victims, knows firsthand the kind of impact slowing down speeders can make. A year after her son was struck and killed in front of their New York apartment, another boy was injured in the same spot. By then, the road's speed limit had been lowered. "That boy lived when he was hit, and mine did not," she said. "When you're going a few miles slower, there's more time to stop, and when you hit somebody, it's much less likely to be deadly." And moving to the inside of the paper here, we have a short spotlight article with the headline, "Steve Miller Band to Perform for U of I Homecoming." This is by David Bauer. Some call him the space cowboy, some call him the gangster of love. The University of Illinois calls rock legend Steve Miller a featured homecoming guest. The Steve Miller Band, which emerged in the 1960s with its blues and jazz-tinged rock sound, has delivered such hits as Fly Like an Eagle, The Joker, and Take the Money and Run over the years. The 1976 release Fly Like an Eagle is on Rolling Stone magazine's list of the 500 greatest albums of all time, and the album Greatest Hits 1974-78 is one of the 25 best-selling albums of all time, with sales of more than 15 million copies. The performance at State Farm Center in Champaign will be at 8 p.m. September 26th, following traditional homecoming festivities across campus. Tickets go on sale at noon Friday, May 9th at statefarmcenter.com or by phone at 866-455-4641. Tickets range from $55 to $145. We also have a few crime-related briefings here, starting with a story here with the headline, "Man Shot in Confrontation with Police, Booked on Attempted Murder Charge." This is by Tony Reed. The Macon man who injured a police officer after ramming a squad car and was shot when he allegedly menaced officers with a shotgun is now jailed on a charge of attempted murder. Oscar M. McMurray II, 38, was lodged in the Macon County Jail Saturday afternoon after being treated for injuries in hospital. In his jail mugshot, McMurray's face shows an injury to his nose and his right eye appears swollen shut. Macon County Sheriff Jim Root told the Herald and Review that McCurry has been booked on preliminary charges, including attempted murder, unlawful possession of a weapon by a felony, and the aggravated battery of a police officer. Root said those charges are subject to review and change by the Office of the State's Attorney. McCurry is due to appear for arraignment Monday in Macon County Circuit Court. The defendant had become involved in a standoff with police on the afternoon of May 3rd at the P&V Quick Stop gas station just off U.S. 51 near Macon. Macon County Sheriff's Office deputies and Decatur Park Police had responded to reports of a pickup truck ramming a semi-truck outside the gas station, and the suspect involved was standing outside wielding a machete. A news release from the sheriff's office said police had tried to talking to McCurry to calm him down, but he ended up running into U.S. 51, onto U.S. 51, forcing police to shut the highway down. It's not clear from reports exactly what happened next, but the news release said McCurry was able to gain control of a sheriff's office squad car and use that to ram a park police vehicle, injuring a park police officer who needed hospital treatment. Police said McCurry had then brandished a shotgun, pointing it at surrounding officers who opened fire to defend themselves. The defendant was hit, although police later said his wounds were judged to be non-life-threatening. A check of McCurry's criminal record shows he has previous convictions for domestic battery involving bodily harm and violating an order of protection. The use of deadly force against the defendant, as per standard procedure, is being investigated by the state police. The sheriff's office is also conducting its own internal after-action review of how the incident was handled, although that is now awaiting information from the state police investigation. We're waiting on the state police to get some feedback from them on their side of the investigation, Sheriff Root said, speaking Sunday. Until we have their report, the internal report can't be completed. The sheriff said such internal reviews served as useful learning tools to help guide police actions in dealing with similar events in the future. Moving on, we have a weather and climate related story on the inside of the Herald and Review here, with the headline reads, "Deadly April rainfall in U.S. South and Midwest was intensified by climate change," and this is by Isabella O'Malley of the Associated Press. Human-caused climate change intensified deadly rainfall in Arkansas, Kentucky, Tennessee, and other states in early April and made those storms more likely to occur, according to a new analysis by the World Weather Attribution Group of scientists. The series of storms unleashed tornadoes, strong winds, and extreme rainfall in the central Mississippi Valley region April 3rd through 6th and caused at least 24 deaths. Homes, roads, and vehicles were inundated, and 15 deaths were likely caused by catastrophic floods. The WWA analysis released Thursday found that climate change increased rainfall intensity in the storms by 9% and made them 40% more likely compared to probability of such events in the pre-industrial age climate. Some of the moisture that fueled the storms came from the Gulf of Mexico, where water temperatures were abnormally warm by 1.2 degrees Celsius compared to pre-industrial temperatures. That warming was made 14 times more likely due to climate change, according to the researchers from the universities and meteorological agencies in the United States and Europe. Rapid analyses from the WWA use peer-reviewed methods to study an extreme weather event and distill it down to the factors that caused it. This approach lets scientists analyze which contributing factors had the biggest influence and how the event could have played out in the world, in a world without climate change. The analysis found a rainfall event of April's intensity could occur in the central Mississippi Valley region about once every 100 years. Even heavier downpours are expected to hit the region in the future unless the world rapidly slashes emissions of polluting gases such as carbon dioxide and methane that causes temperatures to rise, the study said. That one in 100 years is likely to go down to once every few decades, said Ben Clark, a researcher at the Center for Environmental Policy at Imperial College London and the study's lead author. If we continue to burn fossil fuels, events like this will not only continue to occur, but they'll keep getting more dangerous. Heavier and more persistent rainfall is expected with climate change because the atmosphere holds more moisture as it warms. Warming ocean temperatures result in higher evaporation rates, which means more moisture is available to fuel storms. Forecast information and weather alerts from the National Weather Service communicated the risks of the April heavy rain days in advance, which the WWA says likely reduced the death toll. But workforce and budget cuts made the Trump administration left almost workforce and budget cuts made by the Trump administration left almost half of NWS offices with 20% vacancy rates or higher, raising concerns for public safety during future extreme weather events and the upcoming Atlantic hurricane season that officially begins June 1st. If we start cutting back on these offices or reducing the staff, the unfortunate result is going to be more death. We're going to have more people dying because the warnings are not going to get out. The warnings are not going to be as fine-tuned as they are today, said Randall Cherveny, a climate professor at Arizona State University who was not involved in the study. I'm going to move on to one quick international or national update, health update here. At least 10 in U.S. sick from listeria outbreak. At least 10 people in the U.S. were sickened in a listeria outbreak linked to a ready-to-eat food product, and a producer is voluntarily recalling several products, federal officials said. The U.S. Food and Drug Administration said Saturday that federal, state, and local officials are investigating the outbreak linked to foods produced by Fresh and Ready Foods, LLC, of San Fernando, California. The FDA says the 10 people who fell ill were in California and Nevada and required hospitalization. The agency said the products were sold in Arizona, California, Nevada, and Washington at locations including retailers, hospitals, hotels, convenience stores, airports, and by airlines. And I'm going to take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Decatur Herald and Review shortly. Please stay tuned.